Accession number 9364, reel 12.
Mr. Bessel, reel 12.
Shore live in Portsmouth. The Navy had Aggie Westerns, as they called it, which was a lady. She started this business for sailors who were derelict during the shore periods, and you could get a bed there. Charlotte Street was very much a poor type of place whereby plenty of fights took place and all that kind of thing. Generally speaking, there were several theatres in Portsmouth. Of course, there was no radio like there is today, not in the same context. However, we were...
When you had shore leave, did you sleep on board the boat, the ship?
Oh, no, you went ashore. I went, for instance, ashore and came up here to sleep.
So you're on complete leave?
Yeah, you're until the morning. You have to be off by 8 o'clock or something like that, you see, and carry on your duties. If you were watchkeeping, maybe that would cause... Watchkeeping was not a very pleasant task because you never got holidays. If there was a bank holiday, they didn't count. You had to went right through your curriculum of watches. So you never profited by making men's, as they call them. The Navy had what they call making men, where you could sew your pants up in the afternoon, you know, if there was nothing on. And this is where it gets its name from.
What were watchkeeping duties? What did you have to do?
Well, the dogs would be two dog watches, 4 to 6, 6 to 8. Then midnight, 12 o'clock till 4. And then the morning watch, 8 o'clock till 12. Then you'd be off for 24 hours, which you flipping earned because you were always tired the time you'd done it. You would want to go to bed, more or less. So you recuperated during this 24 hours and started again the next day. The other sequence of watches were the first, which was 8 to 12, and then from 4 in the morning till 8 in the morning. That sequence. Of course, you were always tired as a watchkeeper, and you never got any holidays because your curriculum carried on. It rotated, you see.
Why were you always tired?
Well, because you've been up from 4 to 6. In the morning, 12 to 4 in the morning. And that had taken all your sleep out that day, so you had to recoup the next 24 hours, best you could.
And what sort of duties did you perform whilst you were on watch?
Well, if general quarters or something like that was on, you took part just the same. You were lucky to have a sleep on a stool, a long stool, in the mess, you know. But, of course, we were going to transfer, the whole crew were going to transfer to the Revenge, which was become the flagship of the Home Fleet. The same circle of events, where you went spring cruise, summer cruise, autumn cruise. That was 3 cruises. And there were 3 months in Portsmouth, a month each period, you see. Well, they went on leave. However, Admiral Oliver was the Revenge Admiral. He mucked around with carpentry a lot. He used to send for the carpenter to bring him down wood, and he'd saw and hack and chop it and make doors and God knows what. You know, he was quite a lovely man. He was a moustache like a walrus, no beard like a naval customer. He had this walrus moustache. We liked him. He was all right. Well, I was going to talk about Gerns and Cutdrattridge. Both these buglers were captured by the Germans in the 1914 clash. So these were my old soldiers, my seniors. They were 2 years before me. And Gerns, I know, was captured, and this general had him in front of him. He said, what are you come over here for? He was really amused because he's only a lad. And Curran's quite a likeable fellow. He had a brother in the Corps who became a sergeant or a colour sergeant. I don't know what happened to him.
Was he on board the Revenge with you?
No. But I'm just quoting this because I think it is worth mentioning that Kearns and Guthrie were both prisoners of war at the age of 14. Kearns particularly, Guthrie's I'm not so sure. I told you about Guthrie's last time, how he used to bribe the warder by giving him a bar of chocolate to let him go down into Berlin. And Kearns was quite a nice chap. Nothing, he was simple, but he said how this German general had him in front of him and scoffed at him. However, cramming anchor in the Navy was a curse. It was a method of gambling whereby Admiral Beatty, I believe it was, had to get his paymaster captain to work out the odds that a Navy chap had of winning on Crown and Anchor, and he worked it out to 500-1. And he said, there's one way that you could win on a Crown and Anchor board, but you'd want more pounds than there are people on the earth to do it, which would be ridiculous. So you put on a 2 bob, and that would eventually finish millions of pounds after you double it 40 times. And this the paymaster showed them. They used to go in the lavatories and play this game where they weren't legally allowed to play. And then a chap would lose his mum or something. He'd say, can I go home to bury my mum? And they'd say, you got any money? Are you all right? He said, no, I haven't got a penny. And they said, where's it gone? And it turned out to be gambled on Crown and Anchor. They used to say, the more you put down, the more you pick up. And of course, you'd lose your money before you knew where you were, because it was 500-1, which is as bad as the slot machine today, worse.
Was there any punishment if they found anybody? Oh yeah,
the jaunty, or the master at arms as he was called, would take action, but there's so many rogues about, he'd have to have eyes in the back of his head to cope with them all. However, Admiral Beatty did get this paymaster command to logically show you that it was absolutely daft, 500-1 shot. If you multiply 2 40 times, you got more than the population of the world, or about 41, 42, I'm not sure. But the fact remains that there are more people alive today, in my opinion, than have ever lived as a result of this doubling up. It is amazing. And always, if you did double up and you were successful in winning, you would have a little bit more than you'd put on, even though you had doubled up, providing, of course, they win in the end. But providing you had so many millions to put down on your last bet, which, of course, you never had. So it was ridiculous, and it was a curse. Lime juice. The name limey comes from lime juice. It was an antidote to fresh vegetable, whereby it was said if you took this lime juice, you wouldn't get scurvy. And, of course, it was issued on my first ship, but I don't remember it being issued on the QE or Revenge. Rum ration. The rum ration was instituted by Lord Howe, or Black Dick as he was called. He had to quell the mutiny of the Nore, which came about because they paid the Navy with worthless checks. In those days they made their own money, and when they went to London to try and spend this money, the Navy, who were doing 4-year commissions, stuck on a ship for 4 years, never offered them a thing, unless they were ashore on a riot or something. They went to pay for their goods, for their wives and things they loved, people that they loved, and they were refused. They said, this is no money, this is no good. And so you had a mutiny, and was led by Marriott, the seaman, who took the fleet to sea. And the officers made a meeting whereby they said that if he brought the fleet back and behaved himself, and he encouraged other people to do the same, that they would forget it. He came back, they court-martialed him and hung him from the yardarm. And the only way that the mutineers could get it, or Hawk could, Hale could do anything about it, that's the admiral that quelled it, was to order the officers to hang their swords on dragging them on the ground, where the naval officer always does now, which is a bloody shame, because they were, no one was more gallant in pedestal than that when I read it. No one was braver. I loved Admiral Phillips. I used to cut his hair once every week, as I'll talk about later. And he died with the Prince of Wales, and they couldn't have been more gallant. No one could have been more gallant. And I'd like to see that sword lifted up. That's my conclusion. So
these traditions, were they?
They still are today. They still hang the sword on the ground. Have you watched it? Haven't you really? When a naval officer goes ashore, when he goes on a ceremony, he holds it up, holds it with his hand. Otherwise, if you let it go, to drag on the ground, and that's the reason for it. The naval crown is also significant. It has on it top three sails, and those three sails represent the Battle of the Nile. He said, where there's a French ship to anchor, two British ones can go either side. That's where the boy stood on the burning deck, not if he got his appendicitis, but let him off. You've heard the poetry, the boy stood on the burning deck, which we all said at school, at least I did. And that was where, the Battle of the Nile, the French ship in the middle, two British ones either side, on top of the crown, which is on the naval crown.
In the 1920s, were these traditions important?
In history? Would they? Yes, I would think so, because they had a slight ruffle up at Invergordon. You've got to keep loyalty, you've got to be clever. I deemed it that if you're going to run a prison, which afterwards I did, at least you must get half of them, a majority, must make a democracy of it. You've got half the chaps say, well, he's not too bad. He's running this pretty fair. If you get the whole lot against you, you're heading for trouble, as I see it.
Did you hear about the Invergordon mutiny?
Yes,
at the
I
time?
Did. We were in barracks at the time, but it was soon quelled, or nothing much to. I'm not sure of it. Not even sure of the facts of it.
Did it have any effect upon you at the time?
No, I don't think so. The Marine was the shadow on the quarter deck. They always imagined he was the law on board. But the Navy were most gallant, some of them. What they did was too brave for words.
Were there any consequences that affected you of the Invergordon mutiny?
I don't think so. It would have been an undercurrent, perhaps. But I don't think so. They were loyal enough. God knows they couldn't have been braver than they were during the war, because the Navy was under great pressure.
You talked about scurvy. Did you ever encounter any incidents of scurvy?
Oh, no, not even on the Amethyst where I was. This would have been Dad's day and before that, because they were... Imagine the conditions on the Amethyst which I've described to you. The conditions were...
What were food rations like on board Revenge then?
General messing, a difference. They went from cook at the mess, you take your turn, you make a pudding if you can, whatever you fancy you're good at, making fish cakes or plum pudding, which the chap made £36 worth of plum pudding for about eight of us, which was funny. But...
Who ordered the food?
Well, you went up the mess, the canteen, and said, I want a packet of raisins, I want a bag of flour, I want this and I want that. And you made the pudding. And if you were either popular or unpopular, if you didn't make a pudding, you were unpopular. But after this, on the Revenge, they made what they called general messing. So what you had for dinner, I had for dinner, everybody had for dinner. this was cheaper to buy in bulk, that kind of thing, you know. And this general messing was the case.
Who cooks the food under general messing?
The cook, the same cook does it, irrespective, you know. As I say, you had this great vat with this, I told you about the rolling pin in a cloth and poking it down, it wouldn't sink. And eventually you throw it at you, but you may not forget it.
Could you give me some examples of the types of food you'd have on the Revenge?
Yes, I remember one occasion, Chillingsworth and I went up with a pasty which had the potatoes on it had gone blackish, you know. We complained about it. You'd have had, well, corned beef. If we didn't like a thing, we would skylark, but there was no bad feeling. We used to bury the corned beef, you know, that kind of thing. Ashes to ashes and dust to dust. If you'll mess, don't eat it. MS must, and carry on this funeral service with it. The whole ship's company washing. You see, you could look round and where a chap was trying to get a view of what was happening, his head be pressed up hard against the bulkhead at the top, where he was trying to see what what the nonsense was there. And our captain, whose name was Sedgefield, or not our captain, our commander, Brutus, we used to call him, after the dog, the bulldog. He laughed, you know, he used to think it was funny, because it was no bad feeling at all.
How did the cook feel?
Oh, the cooks didn't mind. There was, generally speaking, only good feeling. Amusement, they say, you blooming pasties, but it was not meant.
How adequate was the food on board the Revenge?
Oh, pretty good, reasonably so. Very much opposed to what the Amethyst was when I told you about my first ship, which was an antiquated effort. There were dozens of ships which had good messing at that very period. The ships, did I tell you about the Malaya when she went up the Persian Gulf and Lawrence of Arabia came down to the Malaya with a shower of Arabs? He was fighting a war, helping us to capture Jerusalem, which was vital. And he said, feed these people. And this blooming great battleship, which there were many sunk during the war, the late war, just turned to, got bags of flour up, made the bread, said, here's your bread. So we fed about 1,000 people in a short while. It was this great city on the water, as it was, really.
Did you notice changes then in the food between your days on the Amethyst and your days on the Revenge?
Oh, yeah, considerable. I mean, the stuff went over the side that should never have gone, would have fed people in England. It was sad. You know, herrings in tomato sauce, which I shall talk about later. Bully beef, which they say, oh, I don't want that, you know, and this kind of thing. Good chaps went on leave, they wouldn't eat their meals, and consequently you were in excess. And you could have gone up to the cook at any time, said, we haven't got enough, can you give us some more? And he'd probably said, yeah, take it, there it is. It was quite reasonable. More so than some of the poorer class in England, I would think they were all right.
Could you describe your accommodation on board the Revenge?
Oh, yes. The accommodation, unlike the QE, we had a Marines mess deck, which would have been a small hall, if you'd like to put it that way, with about 8 tables in. That was Queen Elizabeth. When we went on the Revenge, we were messed in casemates. A casemate is got a 6-inch gun in it. Each one, P1, P2, P3, P4, and the other side, S, starboard, no port, you see. And we were in P5. P5 was a mecca of fun. We gave them the best of opera. Sheer fun. The whole ship company used to come down there, well, try and get a view if you could. You couldn't, there was no stalls. You see faces sticking up everywhere, bloke looking underneath, trying to see what we were up to. And, of course, this was all sheer fun. of which Chillingsworth used to have a pair of lids of sea kettle of kettles to make it like he was a lady, you see. And in the casemate, you've got a bow rope of a gun. Now, a bow rope of a gun was there, hung up on the gun itself. And it was possible when you were firing that you'd get what they call a sticky pad. A sticky pad was a pad which had got heated and enlarged and stuck. When you try to open the breech, you couldn't. So you put this bell rope on, and two of you hauled it, and it would come clear, you see. The gun was getting hot firing. So this bell rope was the pigtail of Lai Fang Fu. And we had an orator who used to get out, Jimmy Scott, used to talk about how he lashed this chap with his pigtail. And this is the bow rope. And of course, and Hurley, who was Jenny the parson, would get excited, and he start. There was a big knot in this bow rope, and if it hit you on the bottom, it made you jump. Of course, this was all good fun. Little Chillingsworth, he was a cheeky-faced little fellow, I told you about him on the Kali float, which I was just telling you about more later. Chillingsworth would be the lady, and I'd be used to play for the funeral marches and that. The Death of Ashes. Have you ever heard The Death of Ashes? It's the most miserable tune you ever heard by Grieg, Pig and Sweet. La da 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 la la da. It's all minor. See, I sometimes think that the Arabs. Why can't we get collusion in the world? Why can't we? The Arab wouldn't understand our religion. He doesn't believe in ours. And we don't believe in his, most certainly. I taught Arabs from Collingwood, Iranians, to drive. And they said that their religion was 600 years older than ours. But of course, ours is right. There is no question. Example. We get the God himself representing an example to us mugs. It's hard to believe.
And how much space would you have in your casement, your casemate?
Oh, we're going to talk about that. Talk about Hurley, shall we? Two great characters. Hurley Walker. Hurley was majestic. A big man, extremely wise, would come out with the strangest saying. The lawgiver shall not depart from the feet of Judah till Shiloh comes, he would say. And you look at Hurley and you think, a big man, handsome man, curly hair and lovely complexion, lovely man. Big chap, wonderful bandit fighter. And he would also say, the animal is at the base of humanity. That was another one. He was very human. He was a dynamo that was capable of intense power. You had the feeling that the man had something over and above all others. And he came to a sad end. He was cashiered. He became sergeant major. And it was sad because he used to sing with a staff band.
And was this a shipboard mate of yours?
Yeah, this was on the Revenge, the first time I met him. He sang well. We speak of Elijah and all this kind of thing. He was... a mind of his own, I would convince that you couldn't make Hurley think what you wanted him to make you think. He could think what he thought, and he was wise, no doubt about it. He said that Solomon, the great prophet, had more wisecracks than all the writers in the world. That was his version of Solomon. He used to sing snatches of Gilbert and Sullivan. There's all greatness depends on your knowing them, I think. All the writers put together wouldn't compare with Solomon, his wife. Right? We all enjoyed church service, and the padre was Knight Atkin, very forceful preacher, who spoke very well indeed. Hurley was very sincere and sung well. We all enjoyed it. He could give a funny account of a gun's crew. He wasn't a tragedy queen or tragedy man at all. Neither was he over womanized. You know, you could say they'd gone up Charlotte Street to find a woman and Hurley wouldn't be interested. It was lovely. He's married. He married a girl who I thought was very nice. Gave a funny account of a gun's crew in action. You know, everybody done anything wrong, and he was really humorous. Impressed me an awful lot. And it took something to impress me. He later sang with a staff band. That was our staff band at Eastney, which would have been quite something. And then, when I came home from the Hawkins afterwards, they'd cashiered him. I think drink was his downfall, and possibly his own intelligence. Because he was so intelligent that he would let it bear down on him. I think that can happen. Most popular with everybody I knew. Now, Walker was the other man. I've spoken already about Walker, how he trapped this man with five drafts and he only had one king and blocked him and said, you can't move. And he can't. You do it at the double corner, you can put him there and he can't move. Mind you, he'd given away drafts. I thought he's given in. Walker's given in. He hadn't given in. He was just trapping the other fella. He said, take those two and that one and this one. And then he said, no. It's my move back into the end of the board, and you had it. You can't move.
Did he make an impression upon you as well?
Oh, yes. I queried with Walker. I said, Walker, okay, why do you think a lot of Gilbert and Sutherland always said they're funny? I said, how are they funny? He said, well, this is one of the pieces. He said, Ida was a 12-month old 20 years ago. I was twice her age, I'm told, 20 years ago. Why the hell am I twice her age now? I'm 21, she's 20. She's caught me up. Isn't that fair? The humour, the sheer fun of it. It's so beautiful, really. And this hard man, he was a very good boxer, extraordinarily good.
How important was humour on board ship?
How important? Oh, humour is the basis upon which the world will survive. Do you know the meaning of the word Isaac? It means laughter. And I have heard it said that the Saxons, who landed on our east coast and form much of our language, much of it is Saxon, come from the word Isaac's sons. Have you ever heard this before? You have.
Yes, a little, yes.
Well, as I told you, our coinage, 12 pennies to...